That's just what translation is, I think. That's all speaking is, listening to the other and trying to see past your own biases to glimpse what they're trying to say, showing yourself to the world and hoping someone else understands.
Welcome to the Busy Girls Book Club. We are a podcast bringing you all the reviews and discussions of Book Talk's most popular books and the books that are trending all over social media. I'm Catherine.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Casey. Today, we are reviewing a book that is totally Book Talk viral, known as Babel, by R.F. Kuang. And it is about Oxford students in the 1800s, 1830s, the era of colonialism. And the main characters are all, you know, members of an oppressed group. So the main character is from China, but he's educated by an Englishman who kind of takes him out of China and forces him to become a translator, but he also kind of wants to become a translator. And it's really complicated because the book is really about colonialism and language. And lots of stuff happens from there as the main character, Robin, and his friends all sort of come to grips with the legacy of what they're doing as they're serving the English Empire. So, yeah.
Yeah. A bunch of busy girls that are going to dissect the power of language who are journalists by nature.
It is a book. I think I said the other day, it is the Downton Abbey of books, and I stand by that. It is a lot of talking, but a lot of people really love it. So let's get to our reviews.
I feel like my review transitions this well. It's a 4-star review from Storygraph user FreyaF97, and it says, a 500-page dissertation on linguistics and colonialism disguised as a fantasy book.
Yeah.
Yep. Accurate.
It's very accurate.
I'll do mine next because it really makes me laugh. It's a 1-star review from Goodreads. Can't trust Book Talk. That's it.
Dang.
I'm impressed. Yeah. On Storygraph, I like couldn't find low reviews at all.
Really?
Yeah. Goodreads has some.
Yes, they do have some. A lot of DNFs on Goodreads, which I totally understand because this book, she thick and she complex.
Yes. Yes.
So I actually found one. I went with a 3-star review, and this is on Goodreads. And they say, I recognize Babel as a brilliant work of fiction. Trust me, I get it when you say it's a masterpiece. But all of you forget to mention that Babel is a book written by a brilliant author exclusively for brilliant minds. It's a masterpiece for people whose intellectual level is very, very high. And me, I'm the dumbest person in the universe.
Okay. Are you done? Oh, wait, was that it?
Oh, no, there's more, I'll get into it a little bit. I'll kind of skip some things. I didn't enjoy Babel. Adding a little touch of magic on pages doesn't make a book fantasy fiction. And she kind of goes on to say, like, the author is really staying close to real history. And she felt a little gypped by the lack of fantasy elements. And it was kind of pitched to her as a fantasy book, which I didn't have those issues because it was not pitched to me as a fantasy book. But I could totally understand being mad if you were told this is fantasy.
Well, what I was gonna say after you talked about how she felt really dumb is, like, I feel like I'm a decently intelligent person, and this book made me feel pretty dumb at some points.
Yeah, it's a lot. The author has multiple Ivy League degrees in, like, linguistics and languages, which is really not surprising after you've read it. And I really loved that a lot of the stuff in Babel is rooted in, like, actual linguistic theory. I thought that was super interesting. But there are points where I'm like, okay, honey, let's bring it back down to earth. Like, I don't have a PhD and I have to read this book as well. But I didn't think it was too much, but it's definitely a critique I understand.
Well, and also props to them, because a lot of the, like, important translation pieces involved, like, Chinese or Sanskrit. I'm like, hola, where's Spanish? I might get those, but I think that came up like maybe once in the whole 500 whatever pages. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, these languages are out of my reach, which was like kind of the point, I know.
But. Yeah. I would say I'm at an advantage because I took Latin in high school. So actually some of like the original Latin theory and stuff, I totally knew because of my very rudimentary skills in Latin. And also I love history. So a lot of this stuff I kind of already knew. I didn't know the really depth of British colonialism, but I did kind of know the main touch points as you went through the history. So I think I was better off than most on this book.
I do want to say too up top, if you've read Cloud Cuckoo Land and you enjoyed that, this book will be right up your alley. I actually didn't enjoy Cloud Cuckoo Land, but it's also a book based on linguistic theory, and one of the main characters is a translator. So, and it's also kind of like more of a slow book. So if you are really into these sorts of ideas, I actually felt like reading Cloud Cuckoo Land first helped me understand Babel better, because I had kind of gotten a primer in like this sort of book that like really thinks about language. So
reading the Bible helped me. No.
kinda.
I mean, also Caitlin Bartlett, who joined us for an episode early on, she devoured this book and hyped it up to me. And I think she liked it so much simply because she went to Oxford like a couple months ago and visited, and she was like, wow, it's like real Oxford.
Yeah. No, this book is rooted in reality. Like all the events, like major events, like Catherine was talking about actually happened. And it's just sort of combining it with the magical element.
Well, like all the places are real, exempting, I think, the translation tower.
Yeah. Cause the author went to Babel, or didn't go to Babel. She went to Oxford. And so it's like actually, it's almost magical realism more than fantasy, because everything is actually the world except for the translation creates magic, and that's really the only magic.
Yeah. So it's like almost a hyperbole, not even like magical realism. It's just taking like hyperbolizing the power of language.
Yeah. Yeah.
So clearly we're all like ready for this discussion, but
oh yeah.
We were doing reviews, so we might as well give them what they asked for. Goodreads review overall 4.3 out of 5. Amazon 4.4 out of 5. I think Storygraph was like 4.8 out of 5.
Wow.
Those users are just like smarter. So let's do our personal star ratings. And I feel like we should start with Casey because it's downhill from there.
I loved this book. I gave it 5 stars. I loved the characters. I thought they were all really complicated. I think it did a great job of having a group of characters where no one's really a hero. And there is technically a villain at the end, but it's like a villain you understand. And like, I think she did a really great job making a really complicated topic come to life. That being said, I kind of feel that I feel about it the same way I felt about Atlas 6, where I really loved it, but I wouldn't recommend it to everyone. It's definitely also a book for someone who really likes to like ponder philosophy and like the development of the world. And you have to really have a lot of stamina for, like I said earlier, reading a Downton Abbey style book where it's not really based in action. So I loved it. I didn't see where it was coming. I think we might have to like argue about this later, but I thought it took a lot of really unexpected turns. And so, yeah, I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I think if you like, or you have the stamina for like a slower paced read and you're not really looking for like a thriller, I think you should read it.
Yeah. Well, since I'm second in the rankings of ratings, I guess, I give it a 4 stars. And that's just because I don't want to say I would have DNF'd it, but it definitely would have taken me longer, if not for this podcast, to read this book, because it is not an easy read. And it takes a lot of pondering. And like Casey was saying, I think also you need an open mind to read this book, especially if you're from an English background or traditionally white, like it is criticizing a lot of the history you've previously known and taking a stance in history and a perspective in history that we don't hear from a lot, which is the colonized and not the colonizers. And you have to kind of have this open mind while reading it that you don't take it personally, but you need to understand the history a bit. And that's where I think the footnotes were like brilliant touch, and I really liked them. But yeah, this is a thick book, and it takes a lot of mind power to read it. So that's kind of why I gave it 4 stars and not 5, because it's not an easy read.
Okay, so I was super excited about this book. I'm the one who forced it on our list because TikTok kept feeding it to me because I think it thought I would really like this book. And I really wanted to like this book, and I didn't hate it, but I ended up waffling between a 3 and a 2 and went with the 2. And it's nothing against the author, like beautiful writing, brilliant mind. I just didn't like the structure of the story, thought some of the characters were kind of whiny, and thought it spent a lot of time on the little things and not enough time on the big things. Yes, it told the story of colonialism really well, but I feel like 2/3 of the book was like, I woke up, I hung out with my friends, I read these 5 million books, I did my homework, I ate some scones, I went to bed, and then just does it over and over and over again. And then like the last third of the book is just like, what the hell just happened? And I don't know. I do like that there is no real hero of the book and no real... I didn't mind the end, but also I hated the end because of how it just was like, I'll get into it later, but
I totally
problems are more with the story itself than the writing or the topic.
Yeah. Totally could see that. Valid.
All right. Well, our first question up is it more plot or character driven?
I say character. The first 2/3 of the book have no plot. At least the first third has no plot. Like,
it's
just Robin reading books in a white man's attic.
I actually have like a complicated feeling about this because it is a lot of character and there's a lot of character development. And the first part of the book is just sort of like learning about Robin, and it doesn't really become a story until the last third. Like, I agree with that. But it's really one event that triggers the plot. And I can't say what that event is, but because so much hinged on that one event, I almost want to say plot. But then I'm also in my head arguing, it's like, well, the reason that event happened was because of Robin's character development. So I don't know. I'm like waffling back and forth. Catherine, I need you to help me decide.
No, like I'm literally waffling back and forth too, because I think in theory, it's more character driven because these plots do exist in the real world. But without this character, the events wouldn't have happened, because we know for a fact these events happened, but not in the way that the book ends it with or stuff like that. Like, if you, it's hard to explain because it's so based in reality.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to lead towards character driven because it really hinges on Robin's decisions and his decision making.
That's very true.
I don't know if you bring this up later on, but so the whole book is written from Robin's perspective, except these little mini, they call them interjections, mini chapters that there's one for each of his 3 friends. And I was like, okay, I get it. But also, like, you have this 550-page book and you put, like, 15 of them from other perspectives. Why? Anyway, I had that issue, too.
Okay.
But gave you more into those characters.
Oh, really? I really liked the interjections. Same. I thought they were just enough.
I was also like, you could have just switched perspectives, like, the whole book.
I think they came at perfect times. Like, the interludes literally came at perfect times.
They came because they were things they couldn't explain through one person.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of liked that the book was about Robin, but she gave us those moments where we could, like, actually, like, understand the other characters not from Robin's perspective.
Yeah.
I agree with Catherine. I thought they were perfectly placed. So I didn't have that issue, but okay. Have you read other books by the author? This author also wrote The Poppy Wars, which is really, really popular. And I actually saw a lot in the one-star reviews that people liked The Poppy Wars better. And so they were mad that Babel did not like deliver in their eyes. I'm guessing though, part of it is because they're very different. I've heard that the Poppy War trilogy is like more of a typical story and not like this like long ranging historical like thesis on language.
Yeah.
I've not read other books by the author. And no. I feel like I'm too stupid to read others if they're like this. So
I would read The Poppy Wars though, because I have heard it's different.
The reason I haven't read them, because I've actually thought about it a lot, is I've heard they're really dark and I'm not sure I want that right now. But Babel is also pretty dark by the end. So
dark academia.
Mm-hmm. I would be interested in hearing what like actual student of translation or like a language or an actual student at Oxford thinks of this book.
I almost don't want to hear what they have to say because I feel like they would critique it on wrong grounds.
I would just be really interested to hear like a discussion from them. Like,
fair enough.
Yeah. I don't know, because the author did go to Oxford and also studies language.
Oh, yeah. I firmly believe that everything in there is like absolutely 100% true when it comes to translation and stuff. I'd just be interested if other people, if people who focus on language in their life would grasp the language part of the book more, like the story part, you know. I'd be interested how they perceive it.
Yeah,
true.
I mean, they wouldn't
have to spend as much time just like understanding what was being said probably.
I mean, I almost would love to hear like, yeah, the translation expert perspective and not the Oxford person perspective, because it kind of shits on Oxford and people are naturally defensive people. And so I feel like they would make really like defensive, like, well, Oxford's not that bad. The history's not that bad. And it's like, well,
they were sexist.
Yeah.
And white.
Yeah.
Racist.
As was every academic institution.
Oh, in for sure. But it's like, it's like recognizing your faults a bit. And I don't know if some Oxfordians would be reticent to that.
Yeah. So anyway, I feel like this is like the money question for this book. How was the pacing? How long did it take you to read it? I really liked it. I liked it the most. And I think it still took me more than 2 weeks to read.
Mm-hmm. It took me like a month to read.
When I went to log my finishing of the book, Goodreads said I started it on January 31st. So it took me a couple months to read. I did put it down for a while intentionally to read some other books for this podcast and then to travel, but I really didn't want to pick it back up. I'm not mad that I did. I was just like, here we go, back to class.
Yeah, this book is not an easy pick up and put down book because it's a bit of a drag sometimes.
Yeah, you have to work on this one a little. It's not, you know, smutty fantasy.
No, it's not a breeze to get through. It is a lot of introspection and a lot of thinking.
Yeah, I have like a few critiques of Babel. One of them is the pacing. The pacing is awful. It's terrible. It's true. The first 2/3 of the book have no plot. I love books that have no plot, so I didn't care. I thought the character was interesting enough. My other critique is that there are times when it's a little heavy-handed with its critique, and by the end, it gets a little repetitive. I'm like, all right, I already know. You already told me. I get it. I've been along on the 800-page journey. I don't need to hear it anymore. But I didn't think it was enough to make me not like the book. But anyway.
It was enough to make me not love the book.
Yeah. It's thick.
I didn't mind the journey. Yeah, I didn't mind it. I would say towards the end, it got a little repetitive with its nature because like there's like a huge plot twist towards mm-hmm. the end. And that was really good and well written. But then they kept repeating it. And I'm like, okay, well, I get it. Like, I understand now. We can move on a bit.
Mm-hmm. That's what you have to just be kind of down to, like, walk the winding road, you know? And I was good. I was enjoying the scenery. But
and we've talked about this on episodes before. Like, I'm not okay with the winding road. I need a plot. I need some rise and fall of action. Like, I think that's just my personal preference, which made me not a huge fan of this book. So, like, it's what each person likes. But we've said it before. Casey's okay to meander. And I'm like, get to the point.
And I'm in the middle.
Yeah, I'm okay to meander as long as it's well written. And I feel like the character development's there. If there's not plot happening, there has to be character development happening. All right. There can't be nothing happening.
I feel like, what was the book we had the same discussion? Was it The Vanishing Half?
Uh-huh.
I think so, yeah. It may have also been Aristotle and Dante.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yep. See, I don't like the character developing ones. I want the action.
You want the smut, the fairy smut.
Not yeah. Even that. Like, give me Harry Potter, man.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The wizard smut.
So, you know your reviewer. One of you probably likes
wizard
me.
Smut about Harry Potter.
Yeah, it was a joke. Didn't hit well.
Caitlin's face. She was like, "Don't you dare!
Don't you dare besmirch!
We can cut this
Harry and the gang."
Anyway, so know what kind of reader you are based on what we say, and just decide if you want to read this book. Last question: would you watch a movie or TV show of this book? I 100% would. I think this would translate so well to a TV show.
What? They'd have to explain all the, in this translation with Daisy change with this causes this translation.
I'm telling you, they would just skirt over it. They would
that defeats the whole purpose.
They would de-academia-ify and then just make it more about the story, and they'd shorten, like, the beginning that has no plot. So I think it would work.
Purpose.
I'm on the fence.
If you explain the translation, I think it would work as long as you don't go into it every single time. Like, we get a lot of details and, like, specifics. I think they can explain it quickly and dumb it down a bit.
I just think it's unfair to dumb down such a smart author.
No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Maybe she wouldn't want that, you know, which is fair.
I don't think it would do it justice. Because, yeah, like Caitlin said, it would dumb down a really smart author. And I almost think you'd have to add more magical elements for a TV show. So Absolutely. It would be less realism, more magical. And then that kind of defeats the purpose of it supposed to be realistic.
There's one, the very ending part of the book I would love to watch. And so I for guess sure. That's what I'm thinking of. But
I mean, yes, but you don't get there without all the rest of it. And like I said, I have nothing against the writing. I thought the writing was excellent and very eloquent. And I would not want anything to trample on the author's very hard work.
All right. Well, fair enough.
Who works that hard on a fiction novel?
That is true. The whole time I was reading it, I was like, this genuinely is probably the most work outside of the Bible that, like, a person has ever taken to construct a book. Like, truly, I feel like you do have to give her credit for the amount of just sheer work and study that went into this.
The amount of understanding on all of the topics she was delving into is crazy.
Okay. Well, another thing that I think is going to make me laugh, the busy girl rating. I can just go ahead and start.
I don't even know how to rate this one.
I'll start because then we can all just be honest. It's a busy girl zero. It's like completely like.
Have we ever done that? I didn't know we could do that.
No, like, just don't read it. Like, if you're that busy, like, just because it takes a lot of thinking. And I think part of what can ruin the reading experience is if you take too long to read it, you start to lose all, like, the knowledge that you built up. Like, you start to get the
same time. You need to take a while and read it in large chunks.
And digest it. That's what this book is, like, a 2 week to a month read. Any faster, any slower. And I think it's just like you're getting into dangerous territory.
I've read textbooks faster than this.
Uh-huh. And so, like, you just have to have the time and the space, I think, because you don't do the book justice if you don't.
Yeah, it's a busy girl zero. I'll echo that. It is not for busy girls.
I was gonna give it like a one for the writing, but because I didn't know we can give zeros.
Yeah,
zero. Sorry.
I feel like in our end of the year review, it's like best book. That's the worst busy girl book.
This one wins.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what even some of our other lowest ones have been.
We gave Emma a
Priory.
One,
yeah, Priory.
Emma and Priory. Wow. That's probably the only other two that got low ones.
Yeah.
Mm, wow. Well, we have a new record. We should like create a graph somewhere.
Yeah, like,
like a visual
best.
Oh, that would be so rating. Cool.
Yeah.
Like on a scale of Babel to My Sister the Serial Killer.
Yeah. Yeah, that would
good
be
good scale.
Yeah, I love that. Okay.
On a scale of Caitlin to Casey, how much do you like Dark Academia? Well, I'm a Catherine. I'm in the middle.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. Well, it's now time for spoilers. We're at the spoiler alert section. So if you haven't read the book, stop listening. Or if you're just a realistic girly and you know you're never going to read it, keep listening and we'll just spoil everything for you.
Here's the thing. If you read the Bible, Babel falls, the end.
Indeed.
Like I got to the end, I was like, well shit, it's the Bible. I mean, it's much more complicated than that, but I was like, well, but they predicted that one thousands of years ago.
Yeah. I think to bring up something that you mentioned earlier, Casey, you thought there were parts that were unpredictable. Which parts did you think? Because I thought this book was very predictable.
Okay. I did not see him murdering Professor Lavelle. I thought that there would be some kind of like retribution, like, but in like independence of being like, fuck you, man, I don't fucking work for you anymore. But I did not think that he was going to murder him. Then I did not think that he would murder him and the whole gang would help him cover up the murder. Then I did not see, okay, once we get to that point, Letty turning on them was predictable to me. And then, so the ending when they're holed up in Babel, it wasn't that like I found it that unpredictable. It's just that like I would never have guessed that we would have been there based on the beginning of the book. Like I was just like, what? Now Robin is like leading, I guess the book has to go somewhere, but I did not see like him dying as like a method of protest,
which is like one of my main qualms. I predicted most of it like Catherine. I will give you, I did not picture the entire Hermes society getting killed at the end, including Griffin and Rami.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I felt it was pretty predictable. I will say, on your point on Robin leading, like, the revolution at the end, that was, like, my main huge thing. I was like, Robin was such a weak, wimpy character who just went along with his friends for almost the entire book, and all of a sudden, he's like, never mind, I see the purpose of violence, down with the Empire, and then it ends. And I was like, you, like, yes, you were developing the character, but I feel like that jump wasn't totally developed correctly. I don't know. I thought it was like, well, now that Griffin's dead, I better shoot some guns. Like, I don't know. I didn't like it.
I saw it. I liked it. I thought it was properly developed.
I think it was trauma based because Rami, I think he loved Rami not only in a friendship way, but in a romantic way. Yeah, and the death of Rami really was the catalyst for him to start thinking suicidally. And
that was the other thing. That was so depressing. He was
and
just
then
like,
Griffin died. Yeah.
Might as well take everyone down with me.
Yeah. I will say, and this might be surprising, I did see Rami's death coming and how he died. I totally
predicted it was like the fun one. He was probably going to die, but
That wasn't why I predicted it. I predicted Letty would kill him. I was like, I could see this coming.
I didn't see that coming.
The jilted lover angle. I saw it kind of coming as he keeps ignoring her and the English rose never gets ignored.
I did not see it coming. I was really surprised. I was also surprised by like Rami's death. I was just, the whole thing really surprised me. I really also loved how Victoire ends up escaping and like living and sort of carrying on the legacy. She's like the only one that kind of gets out unscathed. And I loved that. And yeah, I don't know. I thought even though it was really
more of the Hermes Society in the old library, I would have loved to see a love story between Victoire and Anthony. I would have just loved to see like the gang doing some cool stuff. You know, they're in the library for like 2 seconds and then everyone dies. I'm like, what the heck? This was the first interesting thing to happen and you just killed everyone.
To me, that's what really stepped it up the ante and made it more hardcore. Because I was thinking, I think that's why I was surprised, is I was thinking it was going to be softer than that. Like, I thought there was going to be revolution and fallout and shit was going to go happen. But I thought it was going to be dealt with. Or I didn't think the gang was going to be so directly involved in all the bloodshed. I thought they were going to be dragged into it. But it's actually Robin who drags them all into it by murdering Professor Lavelle. And so... yeah, I liked it, but
yeah, I liked it. I saw Professor Lovell's death as well, though. As soon as he gave him the brick, I was like, he's going to use the brick against him.
Also, he wanted him to die, so
we did.
I will. So we haven't even broached the first question Catherine has written here, but have you read a book quite like this? And you wrote, people compare it to Les Mis, and I honestly, when they were barricading stuff, I was singing like. Red and black, like
yes.
You know,
yes. I literally was seeing the scene in the movie when they all like are dead and they come out singing because they're all in heaven in my head as they were doing that.
Yeah, I was seeing like them at the barricade and you know the little boy gets shot when I was like, okay, well
you hear the people sing
revolution now, yeah, but it's all about
hear the people singing the song of angry men.
You know, like, yeah, I just, it was that from then on, I just could not picture Les Mis. Also, that Able dude came out of nowhere and was suddenly a main character. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that was a little out of nowhere, but it's okay.
And it's also wordy, like Les Mis. A whole lot of describing every single thing people are doing.
Yeah.
So, I have not read Les Mis.
I haven't read all of it, no.
So I have
not. It is my favorite musical.
Yeah, I love it as a musical too. But I have not ever read a book like this before. It is so intensely academic. I have never read a book that included that much actual like academic philosophy and research in it before. I also felt like it was pretty, I mean, obviously for me, it was successful. And I think that's, I've never read a book that's managed to be that complex and wordy and slow and academic and still be interesting. Obviously, not everyone will feel that way. But for me, I was like, this book is a success and I'm really surprised.
Like I said, I don't find it uninteresting. I just dislike the structure of the story. And I think Robin's a whiny little bitch.
He is. He is. Yeah. He's a good example of an unlikable main character. But, and normally I hate whiny men, so I would have thought it would be more of a trigger for me, but for some reason I just like was like okay with it. I just think it was,
yeah,
it didn't bother me.
Well, the next question is one I like. The entire premise of the story is that words translated between languages are power, in this instance, a magical power. I liked it because it was a good symbolism for like language's power in general, and knowing multiple languages opens doors to new places, new ideas for you. and the idea that disseminating English over all the earth like kills some words and expressions that aren't in the English language and stuff like that. I found all of that extremely interesting.
What I was going to say is my favorite part of the book is one of my favorite just things that exists that I like to think about is the fact that the words that actually exist in a language reflect cultural ideas in that language and reflect what the language is culturally. I don't know if this is true, but I heard, like, I saw online, there's this meme that in French, there's a word for like sitting on the river and eating a baguette and just feeling chill and at peace. And there's like a word that describes that. And so I love how language literally changes and can be so different based on the way like the culture and that language views things. And the book like how, totally off that.
Yeah, how growing up in that culture gives meaning to the words, because like Catherine and I were on a trip and one of our friends was talking to me. She's originally from Belarus, and she was talking about how she still, like, despite being in America for a very long time and speaking really, really great English, like there's some feelings and like euphemisms she just still can't grasp because she didn't grow up here. And like it explores that by taking like Robin out of Canton, yeah, he like knows Chinese, but he kind of views it as a foreign language because he's lost the cultural connection to his language.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because like he's from Canton, he speaks Cantonese, which is still a language that still exists today. But he loses it because he's basically told that no, Mandarin is the powerful one because that's what's being spoken by the government in China. And so he has to dream in Mandarin. And so the whole idea of like, in order to have this power of translation, have these power over these silver bricks, is you have to be able to dream in the language that you are giving power to. So he has to be able to dream in English and dream in Chinese. And just the power of how there's like the discrepancies between words and languages. Like I think it was Wuxing, and then invisible is what turns you invisible, because Wuxing doesn't only mean invisible in Chinese. It means other things because of like pictographs and characters in Chinese and the history behind certain words and languages. And I guess because I haven't had a ton of experience in traditional Chinese or classical Chinese, and I have more of the Romance language background with Latin and Spanish and English, learning kind of the pictograph history of a language and how it translates, I thought that was so powerful and so interesting of like, you give it power through the differences.
Well, and it, you kind of like something you mentioned is something that touched on that, like Griffin can't use the Wuxing because he no longer dreams in his motherland language because he was removed from that culture far too young. And it's kind of, I don't know, that was really interesting thinking about how your language and your cultural upbringing go so hand in hand, and you don't necessarily think about it like on the day to day, but like it's a big deal.
Yeah. I also think this question of like the power of translation is part of what made this book so viral on TikTok, because it's a bunch of book influencers who love language and who believe in the power of words, and we're obviously part of that group of people who have committed their lives to words, like as people who love books and as journalists. And so I think we're just like naturally people who love to think about how words actually have meaning. Like the root of journalism is, are you saying exactly what you think you're saying? Are you portraying the true meaning of what's happening in a way that everyone is understanding the same idea and the same picture? And so I really loved that.
Right. And like, so I picked up this book before Catherine and I went on a trip to South America. And, you know, I do my Duolingo every day. Like, you can sit there and do it, but until you are immersed in a culture that does not speak English and you can put some of your language, I don't want to say skills, I guess conversational Spanish to use, like I survived, and it was really like, I don't know, Catherine, if you can like encompass the feelings, but you felt like really powerful when you conveyed what you were trying to say, not in your own language, to someone who doesn't speak, like conveying what you feel to someone in their own language that's not yours feels really great.
Yeah, it's a connection, and the human connection between languages and words and bridging that gap.
So I think I got more respect finishing the book after the trip where I was finally immersed in a culture where I was the outsider.
Oh, beautiful, guys. Okay. So our next question is, really the only magic is with this translation and the silver bricks powering the English Empire. What did you think of this? Did you think of it as like, wait. So what did you think of that being the magic? What did you think of it as a power, as like the moving function of the book?
I like the concept. I'm not sure it was correctly executed, because like I feel like it was very thoroughly explained in the beginning about like this translation does this to make this do this, but by the end they're just like blowing people up with it. I was like, I feel like now it's getting I feel like it made sense. Maybe I just didn't grasp it correctly, but it was a very unique idea for sure.
I loved its uniqueness. At first, I didn't get that feeling. I liked it throughout the novel. The author explains it a little bit less and less as you go. So you kind of just have to like believe it. But I thought it was definitely one of the most like unique fantasy concepts I've ever read, especially to incorporate so much actual like historical events. I also thought that was really unique, and having the power interact with real history was really unique. So I really enjoyed that.
Also, yeah. To be clear, this is the least fantasy book I've ever read.
Yeah, it's like
fantasy is very loose.
It's hard to even describe it and even put it in a genre because it's so just,
I would say magical realism. Middle.
Yeah.
Magical historical fiction.
That's what I would say.
Yeah, that feels right to me.
Historical fiction. The only category it can go into.
Yeah.
Historical fantasy?
No, don't say fantasy. I don't think fantasy is accurate. Yeah, I loved the addition of these silver bricks because we can all speculate if this happened in real life, would these things transpire? But I think it truly showed the hubris of the British Empire and their self-reliance on this one source and just expecting it to always be there. Like, I thought that was a very interesting idea. I don't know if that would actually happen. If the British Empire had this giant power back then, would they have like put all their eggs in this basket? But it did. It made me ponder that. And I think, honestly, they probably would have that hubris of like, our language is the best language. It's the original language. It's the we should have all the power. We're gonna give unfair trading practices because in the name of free trade, get all these people addicted to opium, which did actually happen.
Yeah.
And get silver in return. So I think that was so interesting. It showed kind of a biblical story with Babel, and then also the hubris of this British Empire and their thinking.
Well, and I think, you know, the main theme is colonialism, but that part you're referencing had such an industrial revolution undertone. Like, all of the innovation and knowledge was coming out of English-speaking countries who wanted free trade, but didn't want free flow of knowledge because it benefited them. And I think that was an interesting commentary on that, where, like, silver was putting people out of jobs. Like, that's not untrue in history. Advances in technology were putting people out of jobs and making them poor and hungry, and children were in factories and it was making things more dangerous. This was just a kind of interesting tool to make you think about it.
Yeah, it was a good straddle between like what really happened and then theorizing about something new. I thought it hit a good balance. But this kind of leads us into the next question, which is, as Caitlin mentioned, really the main subject at hand in this novel is colonialism. I'm sure we all knew what colonialism is like before this reading this book, but had you really thought about it in the depth that Babel really evaluates colonialism?
No. I mean, we were taught colonialism by fellow white people. So this was a new perspective on, like, colonialism wasn't just colonizing places, but it was like removing their culture and their means to be a society. But also, this is where I felt like at the end, it just was like, it started very subtle, like, oh, colonialism, colonialism. And at the end, it was like, down with the empire, like, everybody who is sucked. And I was like, okay, like, I got it. And now you're just kind of like beating me over the head with it. I don't know. I didn't love how it ramped up so aggressively at the end when we'd already got the message.
I agree. I agree with you. I think by the end of the book, the subtlety had worked. Like, the book evaluates colonialism so well through the characters that I didn't think she needed to be that heavy-handed about it. And by the end, I agree, it is kind of like getting hit over the head. It's like, girlfriend, we were here. We read the book. I know. But I also agree with you. I had never really thought, I thought about colonialism, but not as deeply or as like with the same complexity that this book introduces. And I really like your comment about thinking about how colonialism also attacks culture and attacks knowledge to try and benefit the colonizer. And that was definitely something that I hadn't like thought about a ton before.
Yeah, I think, because I mean, obviously we grew up in a Westeros-centric country. That
yeah,
was a
all white girls.
All white girls.
European descendants.
Yeah, European descendants in a country that was a former colony of the British Empire. So there might be some more descent to British colonialism, but at the same time, it directly benefited from British colonialism.
For reference to Catherine's comment, we're all either mainly Irish or Scottish.
So if anything, we were oppressed technically by the British, but still.
But actually, the Irish are like a great example of how colonialism... Mm-hmm. like severs you from your culture, and
no one speaks Gaelic anymore.
Yeah, in Scotland too, no one in Scotland speaks Gaelic. No one has like attachments to their Celtic roots, like in all the tribal religions they used to practice, and that's because they became quote-unquote white and now they're colonizers,
and then all their records were burned, so you really can't find a lot of your ancestors through records unless they were connected to the British Protestant Church. So yes, the power of that. But anyway, so
we only
that,
ever thought about it in context, really, of, I feel like, white people.
Of our own experience. Yeah, that's what I was kind of getting
at. Or you hear about like them coming to America and the Indians dying.
Oh, for sure. I think we don't think about China a lot. We don't think about India a lot. We hear about Gandhi. We hear about the protests and getting out of the British thumb, essentially. And we see, you guys remember that almost U.S. history, or was it world history class, where they had the DBQs and they had the image of the propaganda, and it's the octopus with all of the arms going out with the center and the British.
Wow, DBQ just gave me PTSD.
I'm like, stop.
Oh, sorry.
For me, it's the Manifest Destiny one with the woman who's like escorting all the white people to like go murder the Native Americans. That's the one that comes to my brain.
Well, and I think we a lot of times forget, like, India was a huge British territory. And that's why they're reaching for China. And you kind of just think about India as its own magical place of like color and Hinduism. And like, no, there were a lot of white colonizers in India, but like, we don't learn about that in school.
Yeah, I was totally taught like the colonialism of like, yes, it was bad that we treated these people badly, but here's all the good things that came from it. And, you know, it's really not contextualized or.
Yeah.
And like the British, in the name of free West trade. Indies exporting slaves to America, like.
I love the footnotes in the comments where there's like, oh, yeah, we're so good because we abolished the slave trade. And the footnotes were like, actually, no. Sure, on face value, sure, you abolished slavery. But if anything, you still did it with the Indians and tried it with the Chinese.
Side note, I saw some reviews that said the footnotes were annoying. I thought they were hilarious and helpful. That's where all the like witty banter of the book came in, was in the footnotes. And I love them.
I agree. I thought they were so great. My mom.
I see that's your later question. Sorry.
I'll add here. So my mom read Babel and also didn't really like it. She's more of a reader like Caitlin. She needs a little more plot.
Fiona Marie knows my heart.
Yeah. But what my mom said is that the footnotes confused her because she wasn't always sure if they were like fact or fiction. I thought like I didn't have that problem. I felt like I was like, oh, this is like real, or like this is just like a witty comment. But, you know, maybe other people felt that way.
Yeah, I feel like the tones were different between fact and fiction.
Yeah.
I didn't have an issue with that.
And they would mention specific characters when they were fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, it'd be like made up names. Yeah.
The other thing though, the footnotes, it would just be like a Chinese character. I was like, okay, that one didn't help me at all.
Yeah. I'd be like, skip.
I was like, character. Okay.
We can go to the next question, which is, we've already kind of touched on, but what did you think of Robin as the narrator? And also as someone who is sort of an outsider, but, you know, he talks about being able to pass as white and like, you know, he loves Oxford, but he also hates Oxford. And what did you think?
This book is like a study in psychology and sociology all in one, because I mean, you totally can see the human condition through Robin of just like wanting self-preservation and survival. So you just kind of accept things that are dark and bad, and you know they're bad, and they're directly impacting your homeland and your country and people negatively, but still loving it because it's directly affecting and benefiting you, and wanting to fit in. And like every human wants to fit in, but every human has self-preservation tactics, and you can recognize a thing's dark side but still be actively contributing to it.
When I did like his wrestle with morality of like, I have everything I've ever dreamed of having, and then realizing those dreams were given to me by these people who want me to do this, and I'm betraying my homeland by pursuing this dream, but I also like it. It's easy.
Yeah.
It's the simple way. And okay, I said earlier, I think Robin's kind of a whiny bitch for like most of the book. But once he does start developing, I like him. It's just that first two thirds where it's just him like, yep, and I followed my friends around. I'm like, do something.
So I wouldn't say that I liked Robin for most of it, but I liked him as a main character's perspective because I appreciated the place he was at in the British like hierarchy. I wrote like a note. I make notes now for the podcast books as I'm reading them. And one that I wrote down, I'll read out because it's about the whole gang. And I said, though it's sad, I appreciate how their differences in privilege and background eventually drive them apart. And I felt like Robin was a really good middleman where like he is not white, but at times passes as white. So he doesn't really have the same experiences as like Victoire and Rami, but he still doesn't totally fit. And like, it was just, I thought he had like an interesting relationship to his homeland and like growing up poor and, you know, understanding the dark sides of poverty and like not wanting to go back to poverty. You know, I feel like I understood him and thought that he was like an interesting narrator to have the perspective of. That being said, I also did find him a whiny bitch at times. But I think like challenging for me, his like struggle was like challenging complacency and being just part of the British Empire because it was easy. And so I thought he was the right character for that.
Let's talk about how his father, Professor Lovell, just went to China to impregnate some women so he could have some half Chinese progeny to eventually bring to his translation institute and leave the mothers there to die.
Well, we don't know that for sure, but that's definitely implied.
We do know it for sure.
I found that disgusting. But, and like,
Lovell got what
relationship,
he
relationship. I don't even know if you can call it a father son or even like a guardian steward relationship. Like, it's just kind of terrible, but he still has some sort of compassion, and then he just doesn't for.
Well, he beats the crap out of him when he does something wrong at the first.
He still wants his approval most of it until suddenly just kills him.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was like kind of icky.
He was really icky. I felt like their relationship was another like study in psychology of having a complicated relationship with the person who raised you. Cause like you
Stockholm
said,
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Stockholm syndrome. Like you said, like Robin has been like stolen and is given no love, which is part of why I think I have more patience for Robin, is he just had this like terrible, loveless, brutal upbringing.
Victoire was also stolen and received no love.
Yeah. I do love Victoire.
Victoire. Yeah.
But anyway, it's just, he was just gross and disgusting. He was like a good villain to like murder and like have trigger all of these events, because even though murder's never right, it was also like, I don't know, I'm not mourning him.
I mean, he was willing to he's fluent in this language. He impregnates two women to have translator sons' offspring, progeny. And then he's willing to wage a war against that country of his son's origin. Like, that's a terrible man.
I totally forgot about that.
Had they birthed daughters, he would have left them there to rot.
Oh, yeah. He would have forgotten their fucking names. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. He was just so disgusting, and everything he did was so terrible.
Bow, explode. Let's do it.
Yeah. So our next question is just, what did you think of the rest of the group? We've obviously talked a lot about Robin as the main character, but the other characters are also pretty important. So what'd y'all think?
Rami is the sweet, beloved child.
Mm-hmm.
I loved him. I could feel his warmth through the writing.
Yeah.
Victoire, I feel like you didn't get a lot of her development until the end, because she's constantly trying to juggle being a woman, being a white girl's roommate, and being mm-hmm. at Oxford. Letty, I never trusted her, but also I was, once she did what she did, I was like, damn, she really did it.
Letty made me so mad throughout the whole book. I was just like, you are just, I mean, it's not totally her fault. It's the fault of the society that brought her up, and it's really hard to deprogram a lot of the intrinsic misogyny / like xenophobia. And like, it's hard to deprogram what society tells you to think. So I don't totally fault her, but at the same time, I was just kind of like, you are like actively not trying to understand your friends.
At the same time though, I was like, why don't you understand this? And I was like, I'm such a white person, I don't understand this.
Yeah.
<That's> like what, in reality, what? I don't know what my friends of color have gone through.
Right. That was one of my comments about this book, is I feel like a lot of white women can probably learn a lot from the depiction of Letty. I think that's part of why her character can be like particularly touchy for people who didn't like the book, because she's really the point that the author like pushes down the hardest on, of like unforgivable white people sins. But I also loved her because I think it just demonstrates so well the fact that like gender versus whiteness and how that changes where you fit in, because Letty ultimately did belong in Britain, even if the society was unfair to her as well. And that's why she was ultimately able to function within it and try to accept her privileges that she got as a student without rebelling, whereas the other students ultimately did not belong in Britain. And that was part of why they just could not like overlook the sins of the British Empire. And so it was just, I felt like that was one of my favorite parts of just complexity. And I loved Letty's perspective. I thought she was really well written. Victoire was my favorite character, and I wish there was so much more of her in the book. Like, that's probably my other critique, is why wasn't there more Victoire?
Victoire was just so smart and like just the baddest bitch alive.
Yes.
I really loved the gang as a whole until like they were no longer the gang anymore. And I really do think Letty loved them. She just loved herself and her own comforts more in the end. Does that mean you need to kill your like bestie? No, but
she loved them, but she loved them because she wanted to feel accepted and they accepted her. And then she just refused to listen or understand them, though.
Right. She could choose their acceptance or she could choose being comfortable.
Yeah.
In the end, knowledge and power won out.
Yeah. It's so sad, but it's so good.
It was cute when they're all like having picnics and drinking wine and eating scones.
Yeah. You really root for them. Like, I was really rooting for the gang. And it was a harsh betrayal from Letty, but.
But at the beginning, there's a point early on when the gang's happening. They're talking about.
Yeah.
It's when they first get there, they're like, oh, and they're all happy.
Foreshadowing.
If only it would have lasted or something. Yeah. I was when's it coming? Where's it coming from? It's going to happen.
They would look back on this time as the happiest time of their lives. You knew bad things were coming.
Yes, you did. Okay, so now, what about Griffin?
I hated him.
He is the radical, the one who thinks that violence is necessary, which is very controversial.
I feel like his character was important only to develop Robin further. Otherwise, he was just kind of this unredeemable, violent person.
I feel like he was sort of a cautionary tale of like losing your empathy and letting the grind of being like colonized and experiencing racism grind you down. Because he really didn't have very many redeemable qualities. And I agree. I feel like at times he was more of a plot device for Robin than his own character, which I think was another sort of like slight weak point. But I thought he was also good as a plot device. Like, he did the job. So
I agree too. Like, when you put him next to Anthony, which it does for a while, it shows you the different ways you can deal with oppression and affect change, or think you can affect change. And that was interesting, but that was just kind of like a small little moment. Otherwise, he was just kind of like harsh and grating.
Yeah.
I wanted him to be nicer to Robin.
Yes. I want him to be like some brotherly adventurer in the secret society. And instead he was like, okay, bye. If you're not going to help, screw you.
Yeah.
He was honestly a case study in why men need therapy to get work through their issues and not just like push them down and go towards violence. Cause I will say, maybe I'll get on my soapbox for a bit, but I think gender has such a huge role to play in this book, especially at the ending, because Robin becomes a radical, but Victoire does not, and sees the benefits of nonviolence and protest, but she's still willing to do things that are naturally violent, but she sees more of the need for empathy and sees how it impacts people that aren't like impacts the poor people and not necessarily the rich people. Like, it's definitely a case study in how different genders naturally lead and how they fall in those kind of psychological, sociological categories. I thought that was really, really interesting in that sense.
When you get to the point where like she desires freedom because she hails from a culture where freedom wasn't a thing, and Robin just aspires for revenge. So like they're different completely how they come out. And I think it's because she never had the freedom to be a woman on the campus and all that. I think you're right.
And she's a former slave.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, Griffin was sad, but I agree with all those points. I just wanted to shake him sometimes because I was like, you guys could have the family that you never had in each other, but you don't see it. You're too like far gone. And so.
Right. Just ride off into the sunset and be brothers. Okay.
Couples therapy.
That's not how it went.
Okay. But in the end, Robin was more like his brother than he thought.
Yeah. I mean, I think realizing that he was capable of violence really shifted the needle because. I mean, I imagine that's hard to like learn something about yourself, like that you can do something that you didn't previously think you were capable of, and it really rocked his foundation of self.
So the question, it transitions us into the question of, can powerful institutions be changed from within, or does revolution always require violence? And that is still, I feel like, in the book, unanswered, and it leaves you to determine it yourself. And I don't know if I still have fully thought through how deep that was. It's still having, I'm still thinking about it. Like, I'm still thinking after reading this book about that specific question.
I'm also still thinking about it, especially because it makes me uncomfortable, because I mean, I think that the United States is at a kind of cultural crisis point where we're thinking about revolutionizing a lot of systems that have been very bad for people of color. And we are having to ask ourselves, what's the cost? And how do we start over if something's bad for our communities and our society, and or bad for specific parts of it? And everything is so deeply unfair that it's such a difficult question to answer. And I want to say that violence isn't required, but I don't really know that. And that makes me uncomfortable.
It's an age-old question that you see in real life. It's Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X. You know, is it peaceful protest, or is it, you know, taken to the streets?
Yeah, and I think we haven't totally answered it as a society. But to the point of Martin Luther King and, like, the nonviolent protests, they still turned violent.
Because civil disobedience.
Civil disobedience, because people reactionary to their nonviolence was violent. And those imageries and images were then played on the news, which then shocked the hearts of the country, of, like, people getting milkshakes spilled on them just for sitting down. So in a sense, violence still was a necessary component in order to change hearts. And I think it's a lot easier to do that in this day and age, because we have this instant access to social media and, like, pictures and videos and powerful things. But also, you think of, like, a lot of the police shootings and shootings of unarmed Black men, Black Lives Matter. And after George Floyd, a lot of things, I mean, not everything's changed, but things changed because of the 9-minute video and seeing that violence against an unarmed man.
And kind of, it's broached by Professor Chakravarti in the book, where when he decides to leave, he's talking about, like, it's one thing to let these things happen and they're kind of just happening, people are dying. It's another thing to start actively making them happen with malicious intent. So it's like this really gray line of, like, is it civil disobedience or is it violence?
Yeah. And I think I just can't answer it. I'm like, I don't know.
I don't think anyone can truly answer it. But, like, you think back to our nation's history, it was violence that got us here.
Yeah.
Most change is catalyzed by some sort of pressure or violence, unfortunately. Yeah. So I don't know. And, like, I feel like unless you're in a position where you have to decide, you know, I am the flame of the revolution, how will I come about making change? Like, none of us are in that specific position that Robin was in and have had to make that decision. And I'm glad for that. But, like, I feel like you couldn't make, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Because I don't think we can answer it anymore. You guys ponder it and get back to us with your very well thought out answers. And let us know what you think of our general discussion and what you thought of Babel.
Sorry, book talk.
Hey, we liked it. Except for
This is where you should listen to a few of our past episodes and really figure out who you're most similar to.
Mm-hmm.
It'll help that you guide.
Yeah, that will guide your decision making.
Yeah.
Because we all, like, generally like the same books, but also, like, we all still have certain things we like better than the others do.
Exactly. We want to emphasize these are our opinions. None of us have any special right to tell you you're wrong about anything or that we're right about something. We just like to talk about books and we think it's fun. So if you disagreed or you agreed, we'd love to hear from you. Our social media handles are @BusyGirlsPod pretty much everywhere. So give us a follow.
Yeah. With that, I'm Caitlin.
I'm Catherine.
And I'm Casey. Thanks for listening. And when you get a chance, take a break with the Busy Girls Book Club.